Welcome to another episode of the Deborah Health Report, where we dive into current health and medical topics to keep the Delaware Valley informed and updated. Last month, we focused on diagnosing, treating, and managing heart failure, as well as how to prevent it. This month, we discuss vascular disease, including how it's diagnosed, treated, and prevented. Here's Rasa Kay.
I'm Rasa Kay, and I'm talking with Deborah vascular and endovascular surgeon Dr. Gregory Domer about vascular health, keeping our veins and arteries as clean and clear as possible, and what to do when there's a traffic jam or a slowdown in the system. You've heard us talk in this space about how smoking puts the squeeze on blood flow, but there is so much more to it than that. How soon should we worry about plaque formation? You might be surprised. All that and more now with Dr. Domer.
Well, vascular disease is a disease of the vascular system. In very general terms, the vascular system is made up of arteries and veins. The arteries are the most important component, and they're what bring oxygen-rich blood from the heart and is distributed all throughout our body. It's mainly distributed through the aorta, which is the largest blood vessel in the body, and it's about the size of a garden hose. So it's very large, carries a very large volume of blood. Once the blood has been distributed all throughout the tissues in the body, it's then returned back to the heart and lungs for reoxygenation and recirculation. And on its pathway back, it drops off some of the toxins to our kidneys and our livers for detoxification, and then again is brought back into the heart and lungs for recirculation and to begin that journey all over again. So vasculopathy is disease of any of the vascular systems. It could be either arterial or venous. Venous vasculopathy would be confined mostly to people see varicose veins and things of that nature, which usually is not a concern. So when I see somebody with varicose veins, I spend the majority of my time just reassuring them that it's not a medical problem. It's very rarely going to lead to any medical intervention unless it's causing significant symptomatic issues like most commonly pain or itching or sometimes swelling. People can also develop, though, blood clots. People may have heard the term DVT, or deep venous thrombosis, which can lead to pulmonary embolus. So that's a large clot then that travels from that venous system to the heart and lungs and can be lethal. So that's uncommon, but that can occur. Most of what we deal with as vascular surgeons is arteriopathy, so problems with the arteries. So most of what we do, again, is life-saving or limb-saving surgery because of disease within the arteries, whether they be in the carotid arteries, so the two main arteries going to the brain, or the arteries going to the intestines, the kidneys, or the lower extremities, which sometimes require some sort of intervention to either heal wounds, eradicate claudication, which is pain with walking, and in some cases, critical limb ischemia, meaning if we don't do revascularization, the patient's chance of limb loss is significant.
So how common is vascular disease?
There was a study done about a little over 20 years ago. It was published in JAMA in 2001. It was called the PARTNER study. And that's a study that most people refer to nowadays because it was the largest study. And then it also had a worldwide component. But the PARTNER study was composed of just people in the U.S. And it estimated that there was 8 to 12 million people in this country with peripheral artery disease. However, again, that study is very old and based on older data. So the newer estimates are somewhere in the range of 19 to 21 million. And that's because of the larger percentage of the aging population, the increased prevalence of diabetes and obesity, which are significant risk factors for peripheral artery disease. So it's probably closer to the 20 million than it is to the 8 to 12 million.
Well, you just talked about peripheral artery disease, but vascular disease overall?
So vascular disease overall, I suppose you would add several million people then with venous issues.
You talked about veins and arteries. Is there any other way to classify them by process or location?
Vascular disease is a systemic disease, meaning that if you have it in your heart, you have it all throughout your body. If you have it in your foot, You have it all throughout your body. It's never focal to one point in your body. It may never become clinically relevant elsewhere, but it's present. So plaques can start building up in young children that are diabetic and maybe have poorly controlled diabetes or bad eating habits and so forth. So plaque is there. Plaque is unavoidable. Common entities we see as vascular surgeons when we're treating vascular disease. Disease of the carotid artery, so again, the arteries going to the brain. The aorta, which is, again, the largest blood vessel in the body, which can form aneurysms, so bulging of that vessel. And when there's a finite amount of tissue, and so when that tissue dilates, it thins out. And if it thins out enough or the aneurysm is large enough, it can rupture. So aneurysms is another thing people are familiar with and what vascular surgeons do. And then the other is disease of the arteries themselves, most commonly going to the legs. And then the fourth component would be vein issues, varicose veins and swelling and DVT, deep venous thrombosis.
Do you kind of stop at the capillary level?
We stop well before we get to the capillary level.
Okay.
They're just too small to really do anything for. We really kind of stop at the vessels going into the feet. So oftentimes, people with diabetes will have microvascular disease. So even though the larger blood vessels that can be revascularized are completely now open after treatment, and sometimes people with diabetes that don't require intervention but still end up with an amputation of a toe or, in worst case scenario, a leg, because the microvasculature, the capillaries, and the oxygen-rich blood that's going to the tissues does not reach the tissue level. And unfortunately, there is no therapeutic intervention that can be performed. That's just medical management.
So when you talk about the types of vascular disease, are we seeing less of one kind and more of another for any particular reason, whether it's we have better prevention or better meds or better anything?
Unfortunately not. And I think a lot of that has to do with the percent of the aging population. So nobody lives forever, right? And so everybody dies of something. And the most common cause of death is cardiovascular death, heart attack. And I think it's estimated about 600,000 to 700,000 people die directly from heart disease every year. And 70% of those people will also have peripheral vascular disease. So that is going to increase only because of the increase in the population that is within that demographic.
So what's a healthy vein or a healthy artery like? What are the qualities of a really healthy cardiovascular system?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So we don't very often get to see a healthy artery. The only times we see a healthy artery are in our trauma patients that we see. So a young person maybe that is stabbed or a gunshot wound, and then we're operating on essentially a normal vessel. And so a normal artery should be almost like rubber. It's elastic, it's soft, but still firm. It's like a rubber tube. It's very pliable, bendable, and so forth. But as we age, everybody without exception forms arteriosclerosis, which is just hardening of the artery. So we lose that elasticity. We lose that ability for the vessels also thicken. And so the flow lumen, or the diameter which the blood flows through, diminishes as well. And then if you add on top of that atherosclerosis, so that's another form of hardening of the arteries on top of the arteriosclerosis, which is the buildup of plaque. So the plaque is made up of lipids and calcium, and it becomes very hard and very brittle. So a piece of plaque, if I were to take a piece of plaque out, which we just spent several hours last night taking out plaque that was obstructing a person's artery in their leg, putting them into critical limb ischemia, it was almost like a rock. If I were to give it to you without you knowing what it was, you would think it was a piece of rock. So it's very hard and very brittle, and it's very, very different from what a normal artery should be like.
So how does this happen? What causes a rock? or gravel or a concrete lining to take up residence inside us?
Well, the main risk factors are age is one, diabetes, hypertension, dyslipidemia, or increased cholesterol. So there's different types of cholesterol. The triglycerides and the low-density lipoproteins are the dangerous ones. The high-density lipoproteins are the good lipids. So you need lipids. But the buildup of the bad lipids can cause hardening of the arteries. And then the number one risk factor, which is modifiable, is smoking. So smoking is the easiest, if we could get people to stop smoking, but the easiest way to cessate the buildup of atherosclerosis or the progression of atherosclerosis. So smoking, there's estimated to be something like 4,000 different chemicals in the tobacco that's produced commercially. And what that does is it activates a procoagulability, so meaning it thickens the blood, makes you more likely to form these plaques. It activates something in the blood vessels called macrophages, which then can destroy the endothelium or the inner lining of the blood vessels.
So something in the chemicals involved in smoking activates something in the blood to attack your own blood vessels.
Yeah, essentially.
Or irritate or inflame them.
Yeah, both actually. So it you said it exactly. What happens is it causes an inflammatory response and a coagulability response. So it increases the blood's viscosity or the thickness of the blood, but also it creates an inflammatory process. And that's just the chemicals that are in the tobacco. The nicotine also decreases the nitrogen oxide, which causes other pathophysiological problems with the blood vessel's ability to dilate or constrict.
My understanding of smoking and the heart is that it constricts the blood vessels. So that's part of that process,
right,
too. So all of that at the same time is happening when we're puffing anything. Vaping, is that the same?
So I don't know much about vaping, but vaping would still have the nicotine. But I'm sure that it still has some of those chemicals, you know, in the processing of the cartridge or whatever it is that they use. So, vaping is not, you're not getting away from the deleterious effects of smoking tobacco with a cigarette.
So other risk factors for vascular disease?
Diabetes is probably the other one that's the biggest one, especially in our population now. Obesity is more and more of a problem. So uncontrolled diabetes can definitely lead to increased risk for amputation. So vascular disease leading to that. I think it's important to understand, so we would categorize people with vascular disease into two broad categories, because we're talking again about 20 million people. So people are going to hear that number and think, oh my God, you know, that's a large number. But the vast majority of people of that 20 million are asymptomatic. But asymptomatic doesn't get you completely off the hook. It just means that you need to engage with your primary care physicians about being on the appropriate medications, first being diagnosed with it. So an important component of that partner's study that I mentioned, 20% of those patients, these were patients within family practitioner's practice. So they were already engaged with a physician. 20% of those patients that were already engaged, though, were undiagnosed with peripheral vascular disease. So all of these patients then underwent a screening process, and they found that 20% were undiagnosed and untreated.
Because they were asymptomatic or?
Because they were asymptomatic. So when you're asymptomatic, nothing needs to be done from an interventional standpoint. But you do need to, again, engage with your primary care physicians about being on appropriate medications, which means probably a statin, sometimes an antiplatelet, like a baby aspirin, which many people are on. So that was more of an issue 20 years ago. It's still an issue today, but not nearly the focus of what it was before.
So vascular disease is not necessarily one of those silent killers. Generally, you're going to have some kind of symptomology show up by the time it becomes really dangerous.
That's a Really good question, and the answer to that is not exactly. Mm-hmm. So people can have underlying coronary artery disease and not have any symptoms until they have a heart attack. People can have carotid artery disease, so disease in the blood vessels, again, going to their brain, and never have a symptom until they have a stroke. People can also have disease in their legs and be relatively asymptomatic. The vast majority of people that have significant plaque that leads to their legs are symptomatic, and so we usually pick up on those people, or the primary care physicians pick up on those people and then send them to us. So, yeah, there are still a tremendous number of people that are asymptomatic that can have deleterious events. So that's the importance of identifying the peripheral vascular disease so that those patients then can be treated. And then if it's appropriate, so not everybody should undergo screening for their carotid arteries or for their blockages in their legs or perhaps to their kidneys or their intestines. And that I would leave up to, you know, either the patients coming in to see us and us determining whether any screening should be done or through their primary care physicians. And there are very specific protocols about who should be screened and who shouldn't be screened.
The problems that vascular disease causing you mentioned a bunch. Does it stand to reason that the smaller the vessel affected, the smaller the potential problem? That, you know, the arterial stuff is way more potentially lethal or problematic than a venous issue?
Exactly. So venous issues, again, are usually things related to varicose veins and swelling and things of that nature, where the arterial system, that's where we get into the either limb-threatening or life-threatening issues. I guess I would go back to, you know, just classifying these patients in either asymptomatic or symptomatic. And then of the symptomatic patients, we have claudicants, which is the vast majority of people that are symptomatic. And claudication just simply means that when they ambulate or when they walk a certain distance, because of the restricted blood flow secondary to the plaques in the vessels, either in their aorta or in their legs, diminishes the amount of oxygen-rich blood that can be delivered to the muscle tissue, and so the muscle tissue develops lactic acid, which creates pain. None of it being dangerous, but it creates pain and discomfort. And the vast majority of those people don't ever need treatment. They need medical management. They need to be put into a surveillance program. They need understanding of what they can do to minimize the progression of that vascular disease. But about 5 to 10% of those people will then progress to critical limb ischemia. So critical limb ischemia means that we need to revascularize whichever part of the arterial tree is involved in order to prevent limb loss. So it's a small percentage of all the people that have peripheral vascular disease. And I spend probably 80% of my time convincing people they don't need any kind of surgery, that it's just medical management and appropriate therapeutics. Like Deborah has now started a walking exercise program, which there are several now around the country, which is now covered by insurance carriers and Medicare. And by putting people into a walking exercise program that have claudication, many of them will come out at the end of the program, typically a 3-month program, with improvement. So if they came into the program only able to walk a block, many of them will be able to double or triple that walking endurance and not need any kind of intervention.
Now, what is happening during that process then? Are we improving the elasticity and the function of their existing system?
So I guess it's multifactorial. One is now they're in a program, so they've made the decision to do something about their problem, which is peripheral vascular disease. So it's about diet. It's about stopping smoking. It's about controlling their diabetes. And then the walking piece is additive to that. So if it was just the walking, we probably wouldn't have the same kind of results. But the fact that somebody is going to now make the decision to do something about their problem, then I think they're going to be much more responsive into controlling all of their modifiable risk factors. But with just the walking exercise, it does increase the collateral circulation. And so what I describe to patients is the secondary blood vessels. So you may have a blockage of the superficial, it's called the superficial femoral artery, which is the artery that leads from the groin down to the knee. That's the most common vessel we see in people with claudication that has disease. And even with a complete occlusion, you may not need and most likely will not need any kind of surgical intervention. So what the walking does is help to build up the robust flow of the collateral circulation or these secondary blood vessels. And those secondary blood vessels will actually increase in size and the efficiency with which they carry blood. So that's what the walking component of it will do.
Even if you have a complete occlusion and the other parts of the system step up, no pun intended, to pick up the slack, what happens when that other vessel is blocked? Where does the blood go? What happens there that you don't have to do anything about that? I'm trying to wrap my mind around now. That's okay.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. I mean, if you were to take a young, healthy person, so again, a trauma patient, and you were to ligate or cut off that blood flow, or somebody else has cut off the blood flow with either a gunshot or a knife wound, that person's leg will probably not survive without revascularization, meaning doing a bypass or putting that artery back together. However, you take somebody maybe in their 70s that has claudication, that vessel likely will be completely occluded. So they're, over time, they have just developed these secondary pathways around that blockage. And most of these people do not ever need anything. Of those claudicants that we see, we will do some sort of intervention on about 20% of those people, but they have to be life-limiting claudicants. So in other words, they have to be telling me that they can't complete their shopping chores, or they can't walk to their car out in the parking lot without having to stop several times. Or the classic is the mailman that still is on a walking path that can't complete his mailman duties during the course of a day without having to stop several times. So it takes him, you know, two or three times longer to complete his duties.
That's vascular and endovascular surgeon Dr. Gregory Domer. In our next segment, we'll get into more detail on why sometimes he and his team would prefer not to perform an intervention, even if it means living with discomfort, and the kind of scary sounding notion of living with an aneurysm. You'll want to understand all of this, so do check it out. As always, the next pod drops the first Wednesday of the month. I'm Rasa Kay.
You can always listen to all of the informative Deborah Doctor interviews at DeborahHealthReport.com. Schedule an appointment at DemandDeborah.org.